are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, February 28th, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Wednesday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Murtaza Hussein, columnist, reporter for The Intercept. We're talking about Trump's global war on civilians, civilian casualties soaring in Iraq and Syria in 2017. Is a message trickling down from the top, from Trump and Mattis? Plus, ISIS is in retreat. What does that mean for the Middle East and American foreign policy? All that and more with Murtaza Hussein. Jared Kushner looks like he's not keeping his security clearance, and at least four countries have not engaged in the incredible strategic malpractice of not attempting to exploit Jared Kushner's naivete. At least four countries. I can't believe it would just be four. Have attempted to exploit Jared Kushner's naivete and business arrangements in order to manipulate him in their foreign policy dealings.
It would be an oversight by the other countries.
It would be an incredible oversight. The U.S. Housing Department has spent $165,000 on its own furniture, and Ben Carson, $31,000 on a dining set. Booyah! Cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching. But homeless people should take more self-responsibility.
My family eating real good.
My family eating good. We eating in China. FedEx's secret deal with the NRA and the gun lobby. More extreme weather patterns in the Arctic because, of course, of the Chinese hoax of global warming. Dick's, major gun retailer, will stop selling assault-style rifles. West Virginia teachers returning to the classroom after a win. They've announced a deal they've cut with West Virginia's Republican governor to include a pay raise. Alex Jones begging David Hogg for his YouTube back and to stop being bullied. And Trump campaign chief's lens named to a penny stock felon. Sounds like this guy, the 2020 campaign head, will fit right in. ICE confirms 150-plus arrests in California as the U.S. Supreme Court has allowed for the indefinite detention of even some people with legal status in the United States. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Here with, well, I don't get, Jamie does 4 days a week. And Sam, I take those 4 days. I need everybody around for me to say things. Do you see? Because I like everybody to hear what I say, and then they talk, but then I need to talk more. So anyways, that's why it's a sausage fest. I love all those tweets, like, it's really sausage fest. it was in my rider. I was like, I would only men will I host. Actually, it's really fun. It's fun when it's the four of us. When there's been some Fridays, there's been where it's been
like we're unsupervised.
It's like dad's gone. I mean, dad's gone, but it's the full gang isn't here, so it's not quite the same. Somehow conservatives. I think we were talking about this right before the show. How, because of the reaction to the Parkland students by the right, they've kept the news cycle going much longer than you'd actually expect it to go, if we're just being realistic about it. it's almost like the right, like they have meetings where they're like, you know what? The best plan is to just ignore those kids and move forward. It will die out. And then they would look on the TV and they would see a teenager explaining how horrifying it was to have their friends and fellow students murdered in front of them, and calls for maybe some basic reforms of the America's gun laws. And then they'd be like, little bastard, I can't keep quiet. It's a crisis actor. So they've kept it going. And here is an incredible Fox News clip. This is some real heavy duty stupid right now. This is one of those clips where Geraldo is called upon on Fox to be like the sort of like, hey, look, I'm a complete and utter scumbag, but I do have some like basic cognitive functioning occasionally, and I guess I'll play that role. This is Hannity Geraldo, some dude who I don't
know. Dan Bongino.
Dan Bongino, hey.
Former, what do they call it? The guy who guards the, I can't think guy, of the guy president, what? Secret Service.
Yeah, I was in the Secret Frickin' Service. Dan Bongino.
Their august history.
Yeah, they have a great history. I'm assuming he's on the armed teachers part of the panel. And then, of course, now we have Gorka. Just, like, Gorka looks at this and he's just like, oh, I'll raise your reckless stupid and enhance it. Let's take it to 11.
That's exactly right. Wait. But what I'm saying is, if the teacher is there on the scene immediately, the cop had to respond from across the campus. It was a large campus. The teachers are right there. You know, sometimes when you need law enforcement in seconds, they're minutes away. I mean, unless this guy's an Olympic sprinter, I'm not absolving him. Listen, he clearly didn't respond the right way.
He didn't go in the building. He did not go in the building.
The shooter did go in the building.
And you know what?
The teacher was already there. The shooter was in the building. The teachers are already there.
If Israel didn't teach these cops to close on the action, he should be fired.
Dr. Geraldo, the teachers are already there.
There's an issue with this question of arming teachers, especially if they're vets. You don't have to be, you know, a tier one operator or a classified marksman. Where if there's one person in the building who's simply laying down fire in the direction of the perpetrator,
I think it's a terrible idea.
It's much, it's much harder to kill people. If one person had been armed in San Bernardino, we might not have had 14 people killed.
Gorka, is you need guards on every floor. You need the perimeter secure. You need a full threat assessment, security assessment. If we do that for every school, and we have the manpower, and they're on the floor, they're in the building, that's where they should be.
Right. Totally agreed. Let's neutralize that threat.
Yeah. All right. Thank you all for being with us.
Okay, so there's a lot going on there. First, Geraldo is actually being a total asshole in the beginning of the bit. I don't know about this sheriff's deputy, but I've read a couple days ago that the guy was on suicide watch. I think that the most limited claim I'll make is I'm not sure I trust Geraldo to judge this guy's response to that situation. Okay? Then we have Bongino. I don't know what that guy was doing. He was sort of defending the deputy, but also not. I don't know.
He's saying you can't rely on the deputies. You just arm the teachers.
Okay. Yeah, right. Really? Okay. Yeah. You're being unfair to the deputy. You need to arm up the teachers. And then Gorka comes in with, like, basically the teacher in the middle of an active shooting situation should basically just, like, step up and lay down fire.
In the direction of the perpetrator.
Yeah, that would definitely help resolve the situation.
You basically have two school shootings going on.
You'd have like two mass school shootings going on. You'd have a teacher and a school shooter murdering and killing teenagers indiscriminately.
Caught in crossfire.
Yeah, right, exactly. And then National Security Advisor to the President of the United States. And then Hannity comes in and he's like, Yeah, right. Let's just calm it down here. I think the thing that we got to remember is that schools should become prisons. And everybody's just like, yeah, that's true.
Armed guards on every single floor.
Secure the perimeter.
Because, of course, nothing could be done to, like, just not have guns be in schools. Of course. Makes perfect sense. That will be the kind of footage that people look at.
Yeah.
When
one-upping stupid with like every panel member.
You know, those comparisons to Rome, like historical comparisons are tricky, but like I do, when you do dip into Rome a little bit, it's like, no, we're doing that 100%. And then the next question is yes, Rome was as grotesque, it was as imperial, it was as cruel, it was as bread and circus, but was it that stupid? Was there like Roman speakers in the public square saying whatever the equivalent of lay down fire at a teacher?
You gotta have suppressing fire. There'd be much less fatalities.
Yeah. But Augustus Romius is totally not brave enough to have lions patrolling the gymnasium to protect the students.
We need a hoplite soldier in every classroom.
Jesus Christ. When it comes to your health, brushing your teeth is one of the most important parts of your day. That's why Quip has combined dentistry and design to make a new electronic toothbrush that packs just the right amount of vibrations into a slimmer design at a fraction of the cost of traditional electric brushes. With Quip, guiding pulses alert you when to switch sides, making brushing the right amount effortless. It even comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and can be used as a cover for hygienic travel anywhere. And Quip subscription plan refreshes your brush on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. No wonder Quip is backed by a network of over 10,000 dental professionals and was named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of the year. Find out for yourself. Quip starts at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/majority. That's getquip.com/majority. All right, everybody, we will be right back with Murtaza Hussain. Welcome back. Michael Brooks on the Majority Report. Joining us now is Murtaza Hussain. He's a columnist and reporter for The Intercept. Murtaza, how you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Always a pleasure. You have a couple new pieces out that we're going to discuss. The first one is, civilian casualties soared in Iraq and Syria in 2017. Was Trump's bloodthirsty rhetoric to blame? Now, maybe set up the contrast between the Obama era, when certainly people like you were reporting on and talking about, obviously, civilian casualties in the drone program as an example. And, you know, the overall arc of American foreign policy does include a lot of death of civilians, foreign coups, backing foreign militias, things like that. But you're talking about a specific departure point here in the Trump administration that I guess is both Trump's rhetoric, but also different worldviews inside the military about how to deal with counterinsurgency and how much of a premium basically protecting civilian life is.
That's right. 2017 in Iraq and Syria, and the air campaign being carried out there, was by far the deadliest year of the campaign. It was a 3.5-year campaign against ISIS forces in those countries, and the civilian death tolls increased magnitudes over in 2017. Now, it's not to say that civilians weren't being killed in previous years, of course, including under the Obama administration. What is concerning about what happened, or what we saw last year, was that Trump repeatedly promised that he'd wage the war extremely brutally. He would remove measures to protect civilians, delegate more authority lower down the lines of the military. And, you know, in any organization, there's an organizational climate that's created from the top. So people often dismiss messaging as rhetoric, as just a PR sort of thing or for domestic political consumption. But the reality is that, like any organization, if the leaders are signaling their permissiveness towards some behavior or lack of approval towards some behavior, that trickles down. So what happened, as you mentioned, is that in change of leadership in the administration, there were different philosophies which were empowered. There are certain people who were carryovers from the Obama administration, who were military officials in the Obama administration, who suddenly had a freer hand to engage in behavior they wouldn't have otherwise engaged in. Mm-hmm. You saw a very stark change, not just from Trump, but from top generals about how they're carrying out the war. Things that under previous administrations, generals were never really saying. Or at least in Obama, they were incentivized to keep down because they were part of this coin counterinsurgency strategy where protecting the civilian population is very important to victory. Now we had generals saying, bragging about shooting every boat in the Euphrates outside of Raqqa, boats being the main way for the civilian population to escape at that time. You saw the highest-ranking enlisted officer in the army give a very bizarre statement telling soldiers to beat enemy fighters to death or warning that they beat them to death with entrenching tools. You had talk of annihilation tactics. The rhetoric or the increase in civilian casualties very closely tracks this very marked change in the way generals start talking. So I think Trump's attitude empowered those who may have wanted to take less care of civilian lives in the first place.
What kind of methods are we using here to track the increase in civilian casualties?
So the U.S. government, they have their own official figures. There was an excellent New York Times report recently by Anand Gopal and Osman Zara about, you know, these figures and how vastly underreported they are in Iraq in particular. In lieu of that, local news organizations partnered with international monitoring organizations, have their own metrics for tracking likely incidents of civilian casualties. And it's ISIS-controlled territory. Independent journalists can't operate. However, there are independent news organizations locally which are able to make contact and give evidence of apparent strikes which are carried out. And not every claim can be verified, but certainly thousands more of deaths can be verified than what are seen in the U.S. official figures. And further that, the figures that should come out from Air Wars and other monitoring groups, they're conservative estimates. They estimate these 6,000 to 9,000 people have been killed. If you talk to them, they said, well, this is our, you know, we're comfortable with this number. They could be tens of thousands of people. Right. There's no way of knowing. They have reports all the time. And all signs point to the higher figures being more valid. So given the U.S. government has resources to most accurately define it, they choose not to. This is what we have to go on.
Talk a little bit more about coin strategy and, you know, explain that. And I mean, obviously it had its own very serious problems, and there were, again, I mean, we're not in any way minimizing, I think even in fact, obviously just the utility of any of these wars at this point, obviously, even though there has been a significant escalation under Trump. Mm-hmm. But maybe if you could play off, I mean, there's the rhetoric at the top, which is just sort of really obvious between Obama, who always sounded very judicious and measured, even when he was actually implementing what were, in my view, some very disastrous and abusive policies, versus, you know, obviously Trump's stupidity and bloodlust and recklessness. That's really obvious. But then you also contrast, I mean, even generals like McChrystal and Petraeus, who, again, I can't emphasize enough, it's not as if they don't have many black marks on their records, but they popularized this coin strategy. Maybe you could elaborate on that and then contrast that with Mattis, because there's an argument inside the military establishment as well, and that correlates with the free reign that Trump is giving.
So one thing important to emphasize is that coin is not necessarily a less brutal way of going to war or waging a war. And this, when it first began to be implemented during the Iraq War, it was originally sold, especially to liberals, as a way of a less, you know, less vicious form of fighting.
Right.
This is not true. Coin, if you look at the origins of this doctrine, it dates back to the anti-colonial wars in Algeria and Southeast Asia that were fought by Western powers. And the doctrine actually is about suppressing local militancy and finding ways of undermining at any cost these local uprisings, regardless of the justness or unjustness of the insurgency. And, you know, like, think about it this way. In part of COIN is developing, one of the ways it's sold, it's part of it, is developing local services for the population. The goal is at all costs to make the population side with the occupying power over any resistance forces by any means necessary. Either it's by bribery or terrorizing them into it, or just creating an atmosphere of uncertainty. So, in effect, you know, if coin strategy, sometimes they say, well, it's about you should build schools and so forth and build bridges for the people. Only if you think that the specific action of building a school at this very moment will achieve a strategic goal. And anyone who's outside of the purview of the local population as defined is completely subject to the most heinous violence anyways.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a colonial strategy of control, which they attempted to impose in Iraq and Afghanistan. And one of the big aspects of it is you have to, one, win over the local population. You can't be regularly killing them in civilian casualty incidents.
Right.
So it is part of COIN that you have to minimize this, strictly for strategic reasons, because you need these people to turn, not because they love you, but just because you're the lesser evil, at least, or they're afraid of you, they have to turn against the insurgency. So under the previous administration, this resulted in, at some times, quite restrictive or relatively restrictive rules of engagements. You had to call up higher the chain of command to carry out airstrikes. There were more soldiers were, you know, it was impressed upon them the importance of minimizing civilian casualties and firefights and so forth. And, you know, not everyone in the military agreed with this. They said, well, no, we need a free hand to kill the enemy and so forth, regardless of how amorphously the enemy is defined. So now, with this new administration, the coin rhetoric has completely come to an end, even the including the parts of it about minimizing for strategic purposes killing of civilians.
Right.
Now you have Mattis, others talking about annihilation tactics. And Matt, James Mattis, you know, it's amazing what free pass he gets. He is one of the most brutal military officials of the last 10, 15 years. He's not like a, you know, he's almost depicted as this sort of, you know, we have a love of celebrity culture in the United States. He's depicted as a sort of like monk type character, or like some sort of, you know, he has the character in the media. he was responsible for the Mukherjee wedding massacre in Iraq, an unrepentant massacre by U.S. forces. He has a long, bloody track record in these wars. So having someone like him in charge, I don't see that as responsible or a voice of reason in the administration. I think it just signals how much the Overton window has moved, how the extremists are now being portrayed as moderates in the United States government.
Absolutely. So at the same time, and I think maybe you also would probably want to make the case that not because of this escalation of civilian deaths, we'll get to the broader situation in Syria in a few minutes, but ISIS is actually significantly depleted in terms of its presence in Syria right now. What does that say? I mean, I guess both you've taken this on in terms of the sort of empty promise of ISIS for its own constituencies and the Sunni community it was targeting. Obviously, its own, you know, incredible barbarism and brutalities. But also it undermines a lot of myths and magical thinking about the power of these groups inside the United States and inside the United States foreign policy apparatus that almost keeps wanting to elevate groups, whether it's Al-Qaeda or ISIS, who are, you know, on some level certainly threats and obviously very destructive of humanity and mostly humanity close by them, but are certainly nothing on the scale of any type of like geopolitical adversary that they would be compared to from the 20th century, like the Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union.
Hmm. So the ISIS has effectively been defeated on the ground in Iraq and Syria over the past year and a half or so.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, ISIS was on the verge of being defeated. It was on the way to being defeated. There's no strategic window for them to continue in any way, shape, or form. They were at war with every single one of their neighbors, every international power. The reason that you saw this rapid collapse was the decision basically to wrap this up now. And if the lost civilians have to die, so be it. This was a choice that they prioritized the very quick culmination of the campaign over protecting civilian lives, which if taken longer, it would have taken some different decisions on a tactical level. You saw the Battle of Mosul. In that battle, unlike many other urban battles, there were no exit corridors for people to leave the city as normally to prevent destruction of cities. There's loss of civilian lives. They allow tactical retreats so that the army can move in and occupy the liberate the city from ISIS with a minimum number of civilian casualties. That decision was totally, for reasons which should be deeply reflected upon, it was not granted to people in Mosul. So the war ended very quickly and very brutally at a higher cost of civilian lives than would likely otherwise have happened. But I think also that, you know, the underlying structural factors which led to the emergence of the insurgency are still there. In fact, in many ways, they've been exacerbated. And as much as I would very much argue and have argued before that it's totally not true that this is a civilizational threat to the West. It's not a mass movement the way fascism or communism are. Those movements which attracted millions of people, nationalism. It has a very loud and very very deadly cadre of core supporters. But it's not a mass movement. It attracts people on the margins of societies in the Muslim world and in the West.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that this attempt to depict it as a clash of civilizations, it's not only wrong, it's very helpful to them. So whatever limited distraction they have was hugely boosted by having successfully manipulated the most powerful media apparatus in the world, which is the United States mainstream media. They completely played into ISIS's narrative. They signal boosted them continuously for years and years. I absolutely guarantee they would not have had the traction they would have had anywhere in the world. ISIS was, for the most part, a standard insurgency. They had some novel elements as a result of the use of information technology, but it was not completely unremarkable in history. It was not so different to Khmer Rouge or many other movements which have arisen over the last century or
Mexican
so.
Mexican drug cartels, in terms of they use social media
exactly.
emphasize brutality and things like beheadings and things are actually very prevalent, particularly with like the Zetas as an example.
Absolutely. It's not an unprecedented world historical phenomenon, which it was being portrayed as. It's some sort of the world's ending. This is an ancient clash between civilizations, quote-unquote. I think that, you know, we have a big problem that the media the mainstream media loves notoriety, loves infamy. So any infamous or notorious person who may arise, or group which may arise, there's such a temptation to build on that narrative. And I think that you even saw this with the U.S. election. Like, President Trump, he managed to hack the system. He understood what people like. And I think these groups also managed to hack the system. They understood the weaknesses of journalists and large organizations and what actually makes the news and sensationalizes things. So I think that this attempt to build it into a mass movement was wrong. And I also think, despite all that, it failed. People are not, it does not offer any solutions to the problems people have. Mm-hmm. And in previous generations in the Middle East, for instance, they were leftists. First they were nationalists, then they were leftists, then they were Islamists. They're all aiming to fix the same problem. They have different prescriptions, but they're trying to help people or offer people the same solution to a set of problems, which are oppression by local regimes, international powers, economic inequality, lack of basic rights. They've offered different solutions, progressively more desperate and more extreme as time goes on. And until the core issues are not addressed, there's just going to be some other movement. And it may be even worse. And until we can get the root cause of it, it's not going to change.
Absolutely. One of the only kind of areas in that conflict that I think is important not to idolize, but I think we can have some grounded, certain respect and sort of interest in, has been some of the Kurdish groups fighting in this conflict. And now, you know, the sort of next spillover is Turkey going into Afrin and really attempting to destroy the Kurdish forces, YPG forces, that in fact not only have implemented some very interesting political experiments in their own territories, as well as also being implicated in some of their own abuses for sure, but have at the same time certainly in areas of cooperative decision making, empowering women, different types of political forms, are obviously a real standout in a conflict zone filled with, you know, proxies for either, you know, Russia or Iran on one side, or proxies from the Saudis in the Gulf on the other, all of whom, you know, committing atrocities. Of course, the Assad government still with the highest body count and atrocity rate of anybody. So the Kurds have sort of stuck out in this very significant and distinct way, and also have been very effective at fighting ISIS. Now we're in this horrifying position where, you know, on one hand, we still, you know, Assad might actually send forces in to intervene on behalf of the Kurds to protect them from this incursion if he hasn't already done it. While at the same time, of course, he's still, you know, butchering other parts of the country. And then Turkey is, you know, using this as an opportunity to go back to one of its, you know, favorite bailiwicks, which is destroying, you know, Kurdish rights, essentially. What's your kind of read on the sort of broader kind of collapse in situation, specifically with regards to the Kurds now?
Yeah, I suspect that Turkey is not going to go into Afrin or any of the other cantons directly, because it's going to be very difficult militarily. They don't want to do it with their own forces. They want to use local militias that they've recruited.
What kind of militias are they using to do that?
So these are groups of militias that they've been training, special police forces. The Euphrates Shield was the overarching name of this faction or campaign, which trickled down to many different groups. So these are, you know, like we talk about Syrian rebels. There's no such thing as Syrian rebel. There never really was. There are different groups in different areas. Now in 2018, 2017, you see a lot of countries which are recruiting people on their borders to act as little border police forces for them. So it's separate from, they don't have no goal of changing the government in the country. They're working for border projects in various countries. So Turkey has these troops which are conducting border projects for it, and part of that is finding YPG, which is the major threat Turkey sees now, and that they've given up on Assad. I don't think they're going to go in, because number reason, it will be very difficult militarily. There'll be huge costs. It'll be a PR nightmare, because YPG has a very good reputation. They're also very good at doing PR internationally.
Yes.
They'll definitely blacken Turkey's reputation if they go in there directly. It looks to me what they're doing, you alluded to it earlier, is that they're putting pressure on them to force them to compromise with the Assad regime. And yeah. Turkey does not like the Assad regime at all, but they'll be very fine with the Syrian government having control over Afrin, because they're also against Kurdish separatism. The Syrian government does not want Kurdish separatism at all. They have a tactical alliance with the YPG right now, very narrowly, but they're completely against the ultimate goals. Turkey would be happy for the Assad regime to go into these areas and reassert control, because that means the borders are not changing. And what all these countries are paranoid about, partly as a result of colonial and imperial histories, being broken up along ethnic lines. They don't want that to happen. And even if they hate the Assad regime, they prefer them in power because they have the same interest of not changing any borders. So I think that that's going to happen. I would be very surprised if they can go in. I don't even know if they can go in. I think that having the Syrian government come and reassert sovereignty is their ideal situation. And I think that the Syrians and Turks and Russians and other parties maybe quietly working together despite their public opposition to each other at this point.
What's this main argument now inside the sort of left about Syria? It seems to me that at least a lot of the practical, this sort of dispute about how to view Syria in a practical sense was maybe in some ways overblown, because I think that, you know, people like you and I were obviously very opposed to escalating U.S. military action there. We're extremely concerned about groups that, you know, the sort of similar pattern of money from, you know, and training from the CIA and from Gulf countries going to, you know, radical right-wing Sunni groups. But then the only contrast being that we also acknowledge, first of all, that the initial uprising against Assad wasn't some type of sort of like CIA-engineered, you know, something or other. It was a obvious kind of uprising against an incredibly abusive sort of hybrid neoliberal, neo-authoritarian regime. And that, of course, you know, the other proxy players there, it isn't just the United States and the Gulf states abusing human rights. Obviously, not only the Assad regime, but of course also Russia and some, you know, Iranian presence is sort of inflicting a significant civilian death toll. And that really was, at least for me, my only kind of real argument. I didn't really see, I probably didn't have a terribly different policy prescription in terms of what to do. I mean, is that making sense? I mean, look, what do you think the actual argument is here from a kind of left perspective of what to do about this just, I mean, you know, ongoing catastrophe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, what happened in Syria and still happening is horrifying. It's the worst, one of the, perhaps the worst war since World War II. And it's not anywhere close to ending, actually.
Right.
And because of this horrific scenes we've seen over the last 6-7 years, there's a temptation to engage in counterfactuals. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if so-and-so had intervened in year X, things would have been different.
Mm-hmm.
And as tempting as that is, I'm not convinced that's true, because I think if the United States had intervened more forcefully, directly, if other countries, which were, Syria was their red line, they would have also intervened.
Right.
Yeah, they would escalate too. So there's a mutually escalatory dynamic at place here. I think there would have been more violence. The country would have been even more destroyed. I'm not convinced that it would have been okay. I think the best thing, the only thing that could have saved the country was if the regime had not started killing people when they started protesting, or forced them to take up arms and militarize the uprising in the first place. That guaranteed anarchy. In Syria, and this is very different, the Kurds were very much an exception for this, because in Syria, among the Arabs, there were no independent political organizations which were allowed to operate. The Kurds were allowed to have some organizations. They were very oppressed and surveilled and so forth. They were allowed to have some organizations because they were not seen as representatives of the Syrian Arab population.
Mm-hmm.
So when the uprising happened, society collapsed, they had some basis of organizing, some people who were leaders, some structures, and they could build on that, and they've been able to build on it quite successfully. Arabs, they did not have anything. So when society collapsed, it was just complete bedlam. It was chaos, and people tried to emerge as leaders. It was very difficult. Foreign money started coming in. It was being distributed in ways which were opaque and undemocratic. It led to the emergence of new power structures, people who didn't have the goals of the original uprising in mind. And so you see this very ugly situation which developed. I think when you're looking at it from a left perspective, I think that, you know, we have to avoid the temptation to look at the world in terms of states. The world is not sort of a fictional construct. The world is about peoples, and we can have principles. So, right. You know, you say, well, the opposition is so corrupted, so bad now, so we have to support the regime or, you know, countenance them out of necessity. I think that's very actually wrong, because you could say the regime is so bad, we have to support the selfish, because look what they've raped and tortured X number of people. It's the same wrong logic, actually. Mm-hmm. I think that there are always people, if you look, there are always people who, so they still exist. They've been active in the uprising since day one. They're still there in Syria. They're in exile in the countries around Syria. They are putting out public statements asking for, continue to ask for the goals of the original uprising. So when the left is not in power anywhere in the world, really, like not in a significant way, unless not the United States. So when you're not in power, you have the ability to actually hold to your principles and not compromise them for some strategic purpose. You can actually have the principal position in Syria. You don't have to arm. You don't have to arm a certain group. You don't have the power to do that. So I don't understand why people feel the necessity to take these sort of positions, because, we should be about supporting people, not supporting states. States are our enemy, actually, especially corrupt monarchical states, which are brutal, engaged in torture and all these other things.
Yeah, no, I think that that's exactly right. I mean, if you were a policymaker, you would have to make the calculation of what, and that would, by definition, in this situation, lead to some incredibly hard and distasteful decisions, in my sense being actually, frankly, in the beginning, probably, you know, really pushing aggressively for some type of diplomatic settlement that didn't jeopardize a lot of people's sort of standing to some extent in the Assad regime, but also stop the killing and the bloodletting and hopefully set some pace for reform, right? And I think that would be the sort of cold, you're in a policy-making position move, but that isn't required if you're on the outside pushing, for a more fully principled position and trying to find zones of solidarity. And it's just always been very bizarre to me that that the Assad government would be a place or of sort of wish fulfillment and fantasy for some people who identify as left. It very disturbing and never made any sense. But
I think that it's a very loud minority.
Yeah, I agree.
Because through DSA and other organizations, they have actually people who've thought about it and have to engage in the real world and not countenancing of conspiracies and so forth. They've had good positions, actually. I think it's a very vocal minority. And also people, we've seen there have been attempts by foreign powers to co-opt or to sway the views of marginal groups or marginal alternative media groups and so forth in different countries in Eastern Europe and the United States. I think there's a bit of that as well, too. Not to be conspiratorial, but I think that it clearly is happening to some degree.
Right.
And but I think these people are loud. They're not a significant number of people. And I don't think that, I think that there's still some lessons can be learned. People have learned from this. And hopefully won't repeat the ugly things we've seen in the last couple of years.
Murtaza Hussein of The Intercept. Find all of his writing there. We'll have a link to Twitter and every way that you can find his work on the Majority.fm homepage. And also you can listen, if you're a patron of The Michael Brooks Show, we just did a history of the formation of Islamophobia and Western foreign policy. Murtaza, I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Folks, JustCoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. Use the, what is it? Majority, what is the Majority Report code?
I think it's Majority.
I think it's so. Oh my gosh. Had that written down before, but I can't find it. You can check out in our blog post link to today's deal with Quip. Majority.fm/become a member. That's how this show sustains itself. That's how we're on the air every day. And of course, you get the bonus, the fun half. This is going to be a very fun half that we have coming up at you. Yesterday, Michael Brooks Show talked with Corey Pine about UFOs, the geopolitics of computer science. Then Trevor Beaulieu from Champagne Sharks and I talked about Black Panther. And we went over why Jeremy Corbyn cannot be stopped by the far-right press in the UK and what we can learn from him. You can become a patron get the whole show at patreon.com/TMBS. Get on the Discord, get on the phone calls, get the illicit histories, Jamaican politics, Marxist theory, all that good stuff. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. We'll see you in the fun half.
I give her my love, she says no, 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 no. I give her my heart, she says no, 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 no. 'Cause you're only a friend to me. Only a brother to me. Ask her to walk with me. She shakes her head at me. She's a pretty little doll who says no, 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 no. All the ask her to walk with me. Why can't she ever say please?
Say no.